Good afternoon, and welcome to today's program hosted by the Oshman Family JCC and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Ronit Widman-Levy. It is a pleasure to introduce Diana Niad, author of Find a Way. In the 1970s, Diana became one of the greatest long-distance swimmers in the world, setting a speed record of circling Manhattan Island in under 8 hours and a distance record of crossing over 100 miles between the Bahamas and Florida. In 2011, at the age of 64, she accomplished another milestone goal, becoming the first person to swim from Cuba to Florida without the aid of a shark cage or fins. Diana is a prominent sports journalist and broadcaster of ABC's Wide World of Sports, Fox Sports, and other media outlets. She received the first ESPN Sports Science Newton Award and National Geographic's Adventurer of the Year. She has also been inducted into the International Swimming Hall of Fame and the International Women's Sports Hall of Fame. Moderating on conversation is Alison Van Diglin, host of Fresh Dialogues and BBC contributor. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Diana Niad.
It's my great pleasure to welcome you all here today, and a very warm welcome to Diana Niad. My name is Alison Van Diggelen. I'm host of Fresh Dialogues and a contributor to the BBC Radio. I'd like to start, Diana, by jumping into your most amazing achievement. You were the first ever person to swim from Cuba to the United States in shark-infested waters without a shark cage. And not only that, you did it in your 60s.
May I be so rude, Alison? Because you're a pro and we're gonna dive into so many interesting things and speak with you and answer your questions as well, but I have to say I am just riveted by, seduced by foreign accents. So, It's you know, no matter what you're saying, all I'm hearing is, you know, is it true? You know, I'm hearing the Scottish brogue, you know, coming through. I did a film in Argentina whereby we swam with the great right whale. So, you know, this is a beautiful animal. It's 60 feet long, 120 pounds, and I'm dealing with every day, the man on camera with me was the playboy of Argentina. He wore a pink wetsuit with diamond studs down the side. Wow. He had blonde, bleach blonde hair that he threw back this way, and he spoke in the thickest accent. And I think unconsciously, throughout the making of this film day by day, I started talking the way he talked. And so by the end, the director would stop me and say, "My God, why are you talking like that?" I said, "What?" And he would replay it, and I would say, "Armando, why we not go see the whales over there?" So you have to forgive me, you're such a lovely accent, and so I went way off course, right off the beginning, but I may be imitating you by the end.
That's okay, we can talk Scottish. So going back to the question,
yes.
How were you able to achieve something in your 60s that you failed, you tried and failed to do in your 20s?
You know, people can't understand this because if you analyze sports, you know, what do we say often, that it's the tragedy of the profession of sports, perhaps, that it's the only profession where you have to retire young. I mean, look at us all talking about Peyton Manning. What an old, sad soul this is. He's 39. And it's true if you look at the analysis of most sports where fast twitch fiber and leaping ability, you know, are the elements that make you great at it, then yes, perhaps in your 60s you're not going to have, you know, those kinds of skills. But when you take And let's forget right now about all the emotional and intellectual and psychological strength and superiority that you have in your 60s over your 20s. I think anybody I can look around in this room who's even close to that age will admit that we are better and better and better as we get, you know, through our middle age. But even physically, when you look at the demands of an extreme endurance event. I was always tested in my 20s, in my heyday as a swimmer, as off the charts in terms of things like lung capacity and the ability to use oxygen per minute, which is called VO2 max. And a number of those, you know, scientific studies found me again in my 60s to be just that superior still. So those types of things don't wane. I honestly, if I, right now, if you said to me, tomorrow, you're going to be thrown out into the Kalahari Desert or Antarctica, and you're gonna have to survive for 2 or 3 months, and you know, and dig down to a level of physical and emotional grit to survive, to live through it, what age of your life would you want to do that at? I'd say right now. Even physically, I feel stronger, my immune system is better. I used to joke that in the old days, in the 20s, I was more like a sleek thoroughbred. I was a little trimmer and always sick. Always fragile, but a good performer. And today I'm more of a Clydesdale. I just have a little more stalwart bulk to me, and I think that I'm really even a better athlete, not just a more mature human being. And I am, you know, the perspective of life. As you get older, I used to be angry in the water. I was such an ego that all I could think of was me and what I was doing. If someone handed me a cup, somebody from my team, and in those days, we didn't use the camelbacks, you know, the hose. So let's say this is a cup that has a cover on it, and there's only one little opening because we're trying to keep the salt water out of it. And you're my teammate, and I've come over close to the boat, and you've handed me the cup. If I would look at it in those days and see that the little mouth opening was over on the other side, not easy for me. I'm the one who's just swum for 35 continuous hours. My teammate can't think to make sure the little mouth opening is facing. I would just go into a rage. I'd berate them and say, don't you ever do that again. And I'd be in that for a little while. Well, this time around, I was just in a more beatific sense. I was more patient with people and more in awe of this blue jewel of a planet we're on. So I'm saying that, you know, I think at this age, I think all of us would say that this is more dead center of the prime than certainly being in your 20s is. Yeah.
Great. So, Diana, take us back to those thoroughbred days. You got international stardom by breaking the world record swimming around Manhattan Island. Take us back to those days. What inspired you to jump in the water and say, I'm going to swim around this island?
You know, first, I had been a sprinter, but I wasn't a world-class sprinter. I think, honestly, that I found swimming when I was young, like a child and then a teenager, and I had gone through a terrifying sexual abuse issue years with my coach. It started as a violent molestation and turned into a, you know, despicable coercion, which is almost always the case with this guy. And I think swimming was my salvation. I felt I was safe, first of all. I was in the water, couldn't be touched. And I loved the discipline of it. I loved that this was my thing and I could feel proud of myself. But I wasn't elite, national caliber, not international caliber. And when I found ocean swimming in my 20s, I was elite. I could truly cruise across the surface with a very smooth stroke and a strong will forever and ever and ever. And I was on the marathon swimming circuit. I was going around the world. I was in graduate school in New York City, and I was going you know, to these people, it's a band of people, the earth is four-fifths water, who go from, you know, ocean to lake to river. A gun goes off. They try to make it to the other side first. Very little prize money. A lot of building of character. Wonderful experiences. A friend of mine, when he first told me about this sport, said, you know, all the swims are cold. They're long. They're usually very rough. There's an element of masochism to it, and I thought that's why it would appeal to you. But I had come back to New York City. I was going to NYU, graduate school in comparative literature, and I came back for the fall after traveling all summer on this circuit of swims, and a friend of mine at school said, why are you swimming in Argentina and, you know, and Italy and all these places when the most famous island in the world is right here? You're from here. You were born here. And so I started to research it. And a few men back at the beginning of the 20th century had swum around Manhattan when the English Channel first came into prominence. No woman had ever done it. And I started to research it. And I went down to the very tony 79th Street boat basin in Manhattan where all the rich yachts are and all the people were kind of having dirty martinis and Madras slacks and things. And I would go from boat to boat to boat down the dock and I'd put my hands on my hips, you know, and make an announcement, say, hi, my name's Diana Nyad. I was 25 years old. And next Tuesday, I'm going to be the first woman ever to swim around Manhattan. And I need a boat to accompany me. And they would get on the horn to the dock captain to get me thrown off the dock. And the last boat, the last guy at the end was Ed. And Ed had, khakis that were stained with bait and diesel grease, and his dog is a little bit thin around the ribs area, a couple of broken floorboards on the boat, and I gave Ed my spiel in a thick New York accent. He said, oh, yeah? Well, that's kind of interesting. Tuesday, you say, huh? Well, I got a vet appointment for my dog at 5 o'clock. Can you finish by then? And I had no idea. And I said, we'll be done in plenty of time for that. So Ed became my guy. And that day when we were swimming around, it was a glorious sunny day. It was October 6th. As a matter of fact, the 40th anniversary was just a couple of weeks ago. And I, at one point, I came over to Ed, you know, at the boat. You're not allowed to touch the boat, but you come over close by and you grab a hose or, a sandwich or something to keep you going, a drink. And when I came over, I was taking my little food. I yelled up to Ed and I said, Ed, I don't know if we're going to finish in time for the dog's vet appointment. I don't think we're going to make it. And he said, I don't give a shit about the dog's vet appointment. This has been the most exciting day of my life. Sports Illustrated just interviewed me. You take forever as far as I'm concerned. So, and it was a glorious day. I try to be a progressive person. I'm thinking forward all the time. But I have to say, Cuba will always be special to me. That stretch of water was my place that I became the best person I can be. And Manhattan's the other one. I just did an interview with Robin Roberts on Monday for Good Morning America, last Monday. And she, the Good Morning America people, set it up on the Hudson on a beautiful, sparkling morning. And she asked me, do you look at the Hudson and remember that day? And I must say I do. It was a day of history, and it was a day of joy for me swimming around Manhattan.
And it also opened up a whole new world. You got interviewed by Johnny Carson. You swam with Jackie Onassis. Tell us a bit about that. How was it to suddenly have that huge limelight on you at age 25?
I didn't think about it that way. I think it was much more organic than that. I just, you know, I would be out, you know, Bette Midler lived in my neighborhood in New York, and I was a runner athlete. I'd be out running, and she'd be in her high-heeled shoes like this tall, walking two Pomeranians that were dressed in pink. And, every day she'd see me and say, how you doing, muscles? You know, and I'd walk by the other side. So, you know, then to be known by other people, I was given the key to the city, and I was somewhat known, you know. I knew Andy Warhol and Woody Allen and the people of that day. But, you know, I hope that I haven't ever bought too much into self-importance. You know, people ask me all the time, who do you admire? And so I could say, you know, I admire Michelle Obama, and I admire Martina Navratilova, and you know, all kinds of well-known people whom you probably admire yourselves. And I do. But the truth is, I have a friend, for instance, who, with her partner, decided they want to have a child, two women. And when she was pregnant, my friend, she became ill. And they didn't know it, but that particular infection affected the baby in a big way. And her baby was born with a litany of issues, cerebral palsy, extreme. And she's never going to live what we would consider normal life. So here are these two women who pictured parenting. And they pictured an adorable, chubby little infant, and then a little toddler running around, and then traveling with their child and showing her the world. And then you say goodbye, and they go off to college, and they come home for Thanksgiving every year. And it didn't turn out that way. And they are always, until they die, this child will be in their home, and they'll take care of her. And do they cry over it? And do they say, this isn't fair, this is what we wanted. Let's put this child in an institution. No. They have been dealt what you might call a bad hand, but they don't want to call it that. They love her. They adore her. She finds joy every day, and they feel her joy. So, honestly, I know I've gotten a little off track of what you mentioned, but I didn't really, you know, feel in the 70s like, oh, I'm some famous person. First of all, lots of people more famous than me always, and I'm so glad. Can you imagine those people who are, you know, recognized, can't eat a meal, whatnot? I'm noticed all the time. People come up to me in airports and things, but it's not because they have an image as an actor of something I've portrayed. And that you think you know that person, and you just want to be in the presence of their blue eyes or whatever it is. I've done something that people seem to admire. So when they come up to me, it's with a real effect of what it's done for their lives, and I'm so gratified. I'm so honored, you know, to have that kind of fame. Now I was of course it was before the Cuba swim, but I was at JFK in New York, and I took out my license. I wanted to get my boarding pass, and the airline clerk, you know, is looking like this, and she looks at it. She doesn't talk to me. She calls down to her fellow agent over at the next computer, and she says, "Shirley, Naiad. I've heard that name somewhere before. What is it? Naiad? I know that name." She doesn't talk to me. She hasn't looked at me. And this one over here says, "Oh, Naiad, yeah. Is it Diana Naiad?" She said, "Yeah, it's Diana." She said, "Oh, yeah, she rode around the world or something. She did something crazy, some ocean thing. I don't know what it was." And she says, "Yeah, that's right." And as she's going, she says, "No, you know what, Shirley? It was a swimmer. She was a swimmer. She swam this long thing somewhere." And I'm like this. I said, "No, that's me." She said, "Oh, no, it's not you. I've seen her on television before. She's huge. She's like 6'1", and she has a different voice." I said, "Just give me my boarding pass, so I'll just go to my gate." So I have a certain anonymity within my fame that, you know, has its charm.
That's great. Now, you mentioned earlier about the abuse. Heavy subject, I know, but I think it's important to talk about a little. You suffered abuse by your father as well as your swim coach. Can you talk about how you endured that, and did that give you the tenacity to do this long-distance swimming? Did that fire you up, the anger?
You know, it's such a catch-22, isn't it? Because I hate to think that I became anything strong, anything good in my life because of those people and those egregious crimes against this young person. I hate to say, I never would have reached this kind of, you know, as you say, tenacity, if it hadn't been for those experiences that set me up, you know? How am I gonna come to a reckoning with thinking anything positive? I like to think that, and as my mother were here to say, and actually today's the day my mom died, October 28th, so I'm thinking about her a lot today. I think my mother, if she were here to talk to us today, would say, that kid at the age of 18 months, 2 years, was willful There was a, you know, you couldn't control her. She had a spirit that was huge. So I like to think that I would have been just as strong and gotten to happiness and peace a lot quicker without those two experiences. On the other hand, you know, we're always a sum of all of our experiences. You can't deny what you've been through. I was giving a talk many years ago. Gosh, I want to say it was the mid-80s. And on stage that night, and Allison, sort of to echo what you just said, it is important to talk about it. I don't talk about it because I want your sympathy. I talk about it because it's an epidemic. In this country, around the world, and it's not just girls, little boys, you know, to take advantage of that trust. You know, when you're someone who's held up on a pedestal of a father, a preacher, a coach, a teacher, of a young person, and put an imprint that is pretty much going to be a lifetime imprint. It's pretty hard. I'm a pretty tough person, pretty single-minded, pretty happy, pretty courageous, all that stuff. And I will still admit to you that somewhere inside, there's that hurt, damaged little girl that doesn't surface too often, but I'm not free of her. I'm not free of them, those two men. So I was giving a speech in New Mexico a long time ago, and I happened to mention the story, the issue. It's really just to share it so we all say, let's speak it out. What are we going to do? Even, let's understand the molesters. Where is that coming from in them? What happened to them? How are we going to get to the entire syndrome? And later that night, I went to a dinner, a group dinner, with all the people who had invited me, you know, whatever the group was. And it was an unfortunate choice of a very noisy restaurant. Just the acoustics were terrible, just all the clanking of glasses. And we were at a big round table, you know how you do at a banquet type thing. And you can't hear anybody but the person right to the right and left. You're never going to be able to talk to those other people. And I had already spent a lot of time the evening with this gentleman. He was sort of in charge of me. So I sort of spent my whole evening with this woman. She was elderly. When we first met in the front of the restaurant, you could see that all the people of the group had tremendous respect for her. She was the life of the party, and she had this glowing smile in her eyes. And we were just talking about all manner of things, her children, and, you know, who had grown, and her husband had died, and her area of expertise in life. And she reached out at one point, and her sleeve pulled back, you know, let's say to grab the water glass or something, and I saw the numbers etched in her wrist. And I said, oh, you're a survivor. And she said, yeah. And I said, kind of crazy in a crowded restaurant. Forgive me, this is way off base, but do you feel like talking about it? Tell me the story. It's like the place went quiet, like it is here now. You could hear a pin drop. She was 3. She was in Poland. Father, mother, older sister who was 6. And the father, the roundup of the Jews had started already. And the father said, if they come to get us, they can shoot me. I'm not going. They came. They were given 15 minutes to grab a few things and put them together. And he said, I'm not going. And they shot him. The mother and the 6-year-old and the 3-year-old were put on some train to Dachau. And horrific, inhuman conditions. When the door opened at the platform at Dachau, the mother had the 6-year-old in the right hand and the 3-year-old, this woman, telling me the story in her left hand. And they went down onto the train track, and the mother and the 6-year-old were taken over there, and she never saw them again. And that day, and for the next 2.5 years until the Allies came in, she was made into the SS officer's little concubine. All day, many times a day, at the age of 3, she was forced into every kind of sex imaginable, and I started to weep at this dinner table. She took my hands, and we went over into the area where the waiters, the aisle, were bustling in and out of the room, and we just stood up against a wall, and she took my hands, and I told her, I'm weeping, not only because of what happened to you, but because I told my little silly story on stage tonight, and she said, none of us can compare our pain to someone else. This is your life. You have every right to to live that pain, deal with it the way you can. And I said, well, how did you possibly get this light in your eyes after what you went through? You've had a family, you've had a career. And she said, when it was all over and I was about six, I was adopted by a family in Paris. And the day I arrived at that house, the mother took me into the garden in the back and she held me. And she said, I'll never replace your mother, but I'm just going to try to make you safe and make you happy. And I think it would be best, it would help you if you told me the whole story. Tell me what happened. And she had no idea what she was about to hear. So the child, in whatever vocabulary she had, told her everything. And they wept together. And the mother said, you're not going to believe me, but most of the people in this world are good. And tomorrow you're going to wake up in your new home and you're going to live a happy, meaningful life. And I'll tell you something. I'm not sure anything. Hours and years sitting in psychologists' offices, helpful people, knowledgeable people, and telling the story and talking it out, it wasn't your fault, blah, blah, blah. I don't think anything ever helped my perspective on the fact that you can still find joy and you can still live a good life and find all the good people in this world, even with a bad start in certain ways. So I think that there was a part of me, Allison, even as a child, that knew that other people suffered more than I did. I knew this was all bad and wretched and wrong, and I held it all inside. I was ashamed, as you can imagine. Shame's a big part of all this. But I think there was something in me from reading and from looking and, you know, watching even television that knew that other kids had it worse than I did. Yeah.
Such a powerful story. Thank you for sharing that. I want to return to the joy of swimming. I read your book cover to cover, cried at the end when you finally triumphed after all these attempts.
Thank you.
But you talk about one of your when you're training so hard for what ended up being a 50-hour plus swim from Cuba to the United States, you were doing training swims up to, what was the longest training swim you did?
24
hours. So Diana writes in her book, after a while, doing an 8-hour nonstop swimming training session was kids' stuff. So I would love for you to share with the audience today how you kept focused. You were sometimes swimming in a swimming pool, often swimming in the ocean. How can you keep focused for that length of time and not fall asleep, for example?
I think the key, and you read about people who, you know, are approaching the big alpine climbs, K2, Everest, Annapurna. Sometimes it takes them a decade to get up to the top. Weather, all kinds of organizational snafus happen. And the word is resolve. And maybe that's the word I'm talking about with my friends who have the disabled child. Once they knew what was going to happen, what kind of child they were going to be dealing with, they set a resolve that this is their child and this is their life, and they're going to make it a good life. So I had no idea in the modern iteration of this quest. You know, there was 1978, and when I was 28 years old and giving it a try then. And by the way, Cuba was never to me another sporting event. It wasn't some big endurance achievement. It's clearly all of that. To me, it was beyond sport. And I'm hoping that I achieve that in this book, that there's a metaphor for other people and whatever shore it is you're chasing, whatever dream it is that you want to get to your other shore, you will find a way. And the only way to go about this one is to never go down, is no matter what hits you, whether it's that moment, bad waves, sick to your stomach out in the ocean, whether it's truly life and death and you're hit by the box jellyfish, the most potent venom on Earth, 600 million year old animal that has its sting down to perfection, and it's usually fatal. 99% of box jellyfish stings are fatal. Or whether it's not making it again and looking at another year, unimaginable at that point, to train again, put it together again, it's mammoth. Whether it's the smallest one day, it's the life or death when you're out there, or it's the bigger picture of gonna try again for a year, I had a resolve, and the entire team had a resolve to say, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what comes up. It doesn't matter how tough it seems. It doesn't matter how we get knocked down. Gather ourselves together, get the body together again, set the will again, learn more. Every expedition is a learning curve. Science, technology, even how to tap the human will, the human spirit next time in a deeper way. And you come back at it with new protocols. So I think in the end, that's the word. The way I could come at it, the way I could go to the pool, instead of driving up to the parking lot and I'm gonna be swimming a 10-hour day in the pool, just laps up and down for 10 hours, and that's nowhere near as tough as going out in the ocean for those hours, but I wouldn't allow myself a stream of negativity. You know, like, I don't want to do this. It's so tough mentally. Hey, wouldn't 9 hours be enough? Who cares? I'm the one setting the training schedule. But no, I know, and Bonnie, my best friend, my head trainer, we would know what kind of hours the shoulders need and the mind needs and the entire system needs. And if we decided that was a 10-hour day in the pool, it was never, ever 9 hours and 59 minutes. It was 10 hours because the resolve has to be set, you know, that tough.
And when you made it to the shores of Key West, one of the things you did was make a point of thanking your awesome team. Can you talk about how you assembled that team? You had a team between 40 and 50 people, international team of experts from around the world. How did you find these people and keep them on with your dream of getting there?
It's a true expedition, just as you think of going up Annapurna. It's a vast, dangerous, epic wilderness out there. And you are dealing with Mother Nature on steroids. I just mentioned the box jellyfish. So why, after being stung, and I should have died that night, September 2011. I should not have lived through that night. I think, honestly, it was will alone that got me through it. But to go back out the next time, 2012, without any more knowledge than we had when we were hit by them by surprise the first time, then you're a fool. You know, you were an intelligent group, our group. So we reached out to Dr. Angel Yanagihara, who is the world's leading expert on the box jellyfish, University of Hawaii. She not only lectured us and brought us up to speed on these animals and how they behave and why they come out at the nocturnal twilight. And, you know, she's a brain that you'd be mesmerized by. But we brought her on our team. She came with us. She developed certain gels and goos that repel them. She helped us develop the mask that I used to try to keep them from stinging across the lips, because the year before we had used the highly technical pantyhose solution. When it comes to the sharks, you know, these are the oceanic white tips, the tigers, the lemons. These are very aggressive animals. And they're 50, 60 miles offshore with no reefs, no bait fish to hunt for. And it could be that when I come minding my own business across their surface, making a little low frequency vibration with my kick and my arms, their signal, as one shark expert put it to us, that to them is dinner bell. I haven't eaten for 2 weeks, and there's a nice little morsel going across really close by. So we developed, you know, a shark team. Luke Tipple, you know, is one of the shark experts of the world. He understands their behaviors, not to mention the fact that we go in absolute pitch darkness. Lights attract jellyfish, and lights attract sharks. So some nights you couldn't even see your hand in front of your face, and Bonnie and my people, they're on a boat about as close as this wall over here to you. They're just hearing the hundreds of thousands of times of slapping of my hands to know that I'm still there. And by the way, how will I ever thank those guys, the shark divers? They're in with me all night long. They can never touch me. They've got the giant shark fins on so they can dart around. And using no lights, so they have no aid for themselves to see what the heck's under there. All they're looking for is pairs of luminescent eyes that are the predators below. And we use no fatal gear whatsoever. Luke Tipple, none of our guys would ever kill an animal. That's their territory. It's not up to us to just mow our way through and kill animals. So they just have little triangles of PVC piping. And when they see the eyes, they swim down and they nudge them. They're very sensitive. They're called ampullae on their noses. It's like their sonar, so to speak. And they go down there and just bump their noses a little bit and get them curious in another direction. How will I ever thank those guys? The navigation is extremely tricky. I'm trying to go almost due north, but over here, out of the Yucatan Channel has come the raging Gulf Stream. It's a very wide, look at it as a river within the ocean. If I'm trying to swim 110 miles, that Gulf Stream some days is 80 miles wide, and it is going due east while I'm trying to go due north. And every time you stop, you come over to the boat and Bonnie gives you a little bit of food, some electrolyte drink, and you're treading water. You can't touch the boat, you can't get out on the boat, but you can get all kinds of nourishment and medicine and whatever you need. Well, for that few minutes that I'm treading water and taking care of business, you've got to pee, et cetera, you're going east. The current is dragging you to the east. And then if you have a crisis, if you're in the middle of a hallucination, if you're feeling hypothermia, if you've got extreme nausea going, and you do. You will go through all these crises many times. Now you're stopped with the med team and Bonnie and the group and talking to the navigator about, you know, what we're going to do. You might be stopped now for 11 minutes or 17 minutes or longer than just that quick pit stop, and now you're going way east, and pretty soon you're not at 110 miles anymore. You're out here with a tangent of 140 or farther. When I didn't make the swim with the box jellyfish stings in 2011, and I'm proud of the fact that I didn't stop with the stings themselves. I was in full-on anaphylactic shock. You know, a tentacle, just a shard of tentacle of that particular animal from just your wrist up here to your elbow has on it 300,000 harpoons. You can see them when you look at the dots on your arm, and there are pictures in the book of that. When that tentacle whips to the skin, those harpoons fire instantaneously that venom into your central nervous system, and you feel the spinal cord paralyzing. And you feel your breath going down to 3 or 4 a minute, and that's when the anaphylactic shock takes over your pulmonary system. And I made it through that sting that night, that first night, and swam all the night and all the day, debilitated, slowly, so I was being dragged more to the east than would be if I were feeling strong and making northing progress as we need to, and stung the next night at dusk again, and went through the whole anaphylactic shock again and swam through that night and through the whole next day again. We didn't make that swim not because I caved in to the box jellyfish. We didn't make that swim because John Bartlett, our navigator, at 44 hours and 38 minutes, came down to the boat to tell me that we were heading straight to the Bahamas and Florida was no longer possible. The way he put it was, "Diana, how do you feel about going to the Bahamas?" And I said, "Not good. I want to finish in my home country." And so that swim was called. And frankly, even to make it to the Bahamas would have been a Leviathan goal at that point. So I'm trying to paint a picture. The 44 people who were my team on that last try, and it varied. Sometimes there were 35, and the last time there were 44, agreed. The tight inner circle is a smaller group. But we have 5 boats because the rest of the expedition that makes up those 44 people are taking care of this inner circle. I want my shark guys to be rested. I want their vision to be very good. And the same with the navigation team and the medical team. So they work in shifts. The shark guys, two of them are under the water. And when they are exhausted, and they are exhausted after just a couple of hours, I'm swimming fairly quickly over the surface, a lot harder to swim at that speed underwater. They're looking, they're in a, on a vigil, that when they come up and go back to their mothership, it's the rest of the 44 of the group that are, you know, on the motherships, and they're sort of on the outer circle of the expedition. But, you know, 2 hours or so from the end, palm trees in full view now on the shore, bright blue sunshine, I asked my team to come over and form a semicircle in front of me right here, and I cried like a baby. And I said, I guess I'm going to stumble up on that beach pretty soon. And I guess somebody's going to take my picture. But don't you ever forget, because I will never forget, that we did this together. We made history together. And that's the truth. I will never forget my team. I never could have made it without them.
It's a wonderful moment. I encourage everyone to check out the YouTube video. And in fact, there's a documentary, perhaps even a movie coming out about this too. But I want to go back to this leadership, because you seem to be an incredible leader. And I think people in Silicon Valley could learn from your leadership. Talk about that. I'm getting an odd look from Diana here. Talk about that last attempt. You're gearing up for that last attempt. But this A-team starts to unravel. Some key members decide they're not with you this time. Can you talk about how you managed to bring that team together for the final successful attempt?
It wore on people. And when I was talking a minute ago about the inner circle, a good example is my lead guy in St. Martin. I trained down in St. Martin throughout the winter each year. I was lucky I had a training camp down there. And there are virtually no sharks in that part of the Caribbean and no jellyfish. So the waters always also stay warm. It's closer to the equator than, let's say, Florida, Mexico, Hawaii, other places you could train. And for something this long, you're going to go out and do 15 hours one day and try to get yourself together. And the next swim a couple days later is 16 hours. Get yourself together. The next swim is 17 hours. St. Martin was an ideal place for it, and I had a number of different people, so we called it Camp SXM, which is really the airport sort of designation for St. Martin, SXM. And Mark Solinger, who's a big 6'4", kind of marine type guy, he was in charge of my training there, and he broke. It was a huge strain on his family, on his finances. Nobody got paid a cent to do all this. And he had, you know, when I'm up at 3 o'clock in the morning with Bonnie, getting ready, hydrating, feeding, trying to get my head to get wrapped around a 15-hour swim, and we hear that the weather forecast is horrible. He's worked the entire day before, and he stayed up till midnight getting the boat ready and getting the, you know, the ice chest down there and getting the weather forecast together and getting a route planned out. And he's up at 3 o'clock in the morning, too. And I think the hurricane, it was Hurricane Sandy, had come through the year before and devastated a lot of his business. So now he was dealing with that. So I don't blame him. He broke. And he was fed up. And on that last swim we did, it just broke my heart. He used to have a great sense of humor. He and his wife are kind of country music fans. And when I'm singing Bob Dylan, I'll come to the side of the road and the boat, and they'll lean over and go, "You could take a ride in my little green track. We could go slow or we could go faster." And there are all these little intimate moments you share, you know, out there that nobody will understand, but we remember. And Mark had no humor that last day. He was gruff. He was almost rude. He was just fed up. He had given too much, and I didn't see it. I needed him, and I needed the training there. It's pretty hard to set up some other training camp like that. And we only had a couple months to go before peaking. And he says, and he cries about it every time we talk about it, that he lost out. He put in all the guts for that swim, but he didn't get the glory. He didn't come to Key West. And we've forgiven each other. And now he's going to be very much involved in the walk across America next summer. So we're back on it. But it's a... It takes a toll, the people on the inner circle. It takes a toll on them, but I must say that most people found it a grand adventure, found it a moment of noble friendship, and found making history was exciting to their lives. Bucko Pantelis was the head of our kayak team. We have two kayaks next to me at all times. They carry an electronic shark shield on the bottom of their boats, and these shields put out an elliptical field of electricity that on most days sharks don't want to come up through unless they're truly hungry. So along with the divers, the electricity is the other, you know, sort of safeguard against the sharks. And I said to Bucko, do you want to go again? I'm going to go a fifth time. I'm going out there again. He said, Diana, I repair air conditioners. And, you know, so to be out with you in this epic experience and life and death and watch you and be part of watching someone, you know, as you had put it today, Allison, a few times, so tenacious. He said, it's changed my life. And, honestly, I want you to make it. But you could do it every year for the rest of my life, and I'll be there every year. So it was a nice way to put it.
I love that story. Talk about failure, because you did fail many times before you finally succeeded. We have some audience questions about this giving up. You know, you swim for 40 hours and then you give up. Talk about that and how you mentally deal with that and gearing yourself up. I'm going to give it another try. That tenacity again.
Well, just to clarify, there was never an occasion, just clinically speaking, when I gave up. You have a discussion. In 1978, we were in a raging sea. It's very difficult to predict the weather conditions there. The winds are blowing from Africa, and they're blowing 7,000 miles uninterrupted across the Atlantic Ocean. And as they come through the Florida Straits, that Gulf Stream I talked to you about that's blowing to the east, that wind and that water current hit up against each other, and almost every day of the year out there, it's the trade winds. You don't stop them. There are huge, stiff peaks. And for a swimmer, impossible to make it across on most days. You're lucky, and the 30-year history shows in the Florida Straits that one day a month do those winds either calm down or they clock around toward the southerly direction to help you a little bit in that direction, much less getting 2 and 3 and 4 days that you need as a swimmer of fairly good calm to try to make it across. So in 1978, we went 41 hours and 49 minutes in a raging sea. We had a pretty good forecast, and the forecast closed in on us once we had started. We couldn't get back into Cuba. Things are opening up now, but in all the years I went, the government permits on both sides were extremely strict, and once you started, you couldn't just say, oh, it's not a great day. Let's pack it in. We'll go back to Cuba, and we'll wait a few days until the weather. No, that's your, for you, that year, that's your attempt. And at 41 hours, 49 minutes, we had to give it up. But it wasn't a matter of my saying, I can't do it. I'm too tired. I'm in pain. I'm not going to do it. It's an expedition, like you turn back from reaching the summit at Mount Everest if your life is potentially in danger to go any further in that particular weather. So we stopped, and we had a tearful, argumentative half hour with the navigator and my trainers and me as I'm treading water, and we make an intelligent decision. Land was not reachable, not possible to reach. We were heading toward Brownsville, Texas, 800 miles away. The weather forecast was not going to be turning around. It was getting worse and worse and worse. So it's not a matter of giving up. Same thing when we were out toward the Bahamas after the box jellyfish. It's let's determine. You know, we're not out there to prove I can swim 100 hours and not make it to where we're going to. If it's just the wrong time, the wrong year, we have been thrown off course, I've been debilitated, we can't make it to the destination, then we all make a decision.
But how did you deal with that crushing disappointment?
You know, it never lasted long. I was usually on the boat. And people laugh when they see the documentary, The Other Shore, because the first words I always say when I'm dragged out on the boat is, my beautiful dream, it's not to be. And then by the time we reach the docks in Key West, which in some cases is 8 hours later, in some cases it's 20 hours later, you know, depending on how far we've been blown off course, et cetera, I'm already churning. Because when it isn't you who collapses, when it is the circumstances, the conditions, you think to yourself, what smarts, what solutions can we bring to that issue to try to forecast better, to try to, is there space telemetry that can look down at those swirling eddies within the Gulf Stream to see if we can avoid them as we go around? Is there a way not to get stung across the mouth with that box jellyfish? Everybody else who's ever been in the water with box jellyfish and somehow survived, even a minor sting, especially on this Cuba swim, has said, never again. You will never see me in that water again. But I wanted to find a solution. I went to a prostheticist. He works with people who have been, their faces have been blown up by grenades, or they've been in fires, and they're going to have to wear some kind of protective silicone until they can have their face grafts. And we worked for 9 months on prototype after prototype, trying to put retainers in the middle of the silicone so I could grasp onto the mask with my teeth and force the mouth open. And I guess it's just a tribute to, you know, what Edison said, is that there's only one sure way to fail. You just don't try again. And that wasn't the spirit of our team.
Wonderful. Now, you've talked about being in the ocean, being at one with the ocean, and you've also been outspoken on climate change. Can you talk about climate change from your perspective as an ocean swimmer?
You know, one thing I wrote in this book is, and maybe it's because what we said earlier about athletes being forced to retire young. And you don't have to be a professional athlete. If you love your sport, you're a tennis player, you love your sport. When you see that court, if you're a basketball player, you know, I could picture Michael Jordan sitting in an empty high school basketball arena. It doesn't have to be the Chicago Bulls arena where he was the great champion. But that hardwood, and those two baskets at the end, that tennis court. You know, did you see Martina Navratilova when she retired and played her last match? She went and she knelt down. I could cry. It's to me, it's so poetic, it's so moving. And she tugged a couple of tufts of that grass. Her place of triumph, her place of victory, her home. And she took a couple of blades of grass from the Wimbledon court, and she tucked them in your pocket. She'll have them forever. Well, my place was not only the ocean. We could go here in this beautiful ocean you live near and look out at the Pacific, and I feel it. I feel the earth. I feel this blue jewel of a planet, and am in awe of it, in love with it, enamored by it. But that ocean between Cuba and Florida, that was my home court. And when I look out at it, I just am filled with the emotion of how vast it is, what a learning ground it was for me, what a special place it was for me. And I do feel that looking at the Hudson River, you know, in Manhattan as well. So I was listening to a glaciologist the other day. I was at a convention where I was sort of the motivational speaker, but I went to hear some of the other people. It was an environmental conference. And evidently a number, I'm sure many of you are more versed in this than I am, but a number of environmentalists and especially climate issues and glaciologists say that we all, our heartstrings tug when we see the polar bear losing their ground. And it's not going to be so simple as to just evacuate all the polar bear of the Arctic and move them to the Antarctic, to different ice. They wouldn't survive there. That is their environment, the Arctic, not the Antarctic. And they're losing literally ice to stand on. They're going to starve. So we feel that, and we write out checks to the, you know, to the societies that protect polar bear. But this glaciologist was saying that if we continue at the precise same speed of using fossil fuels And look at me, I'm sitting up here lecturing. I still drive a Volvo car that uses real gas. I got to get with it. If we keep using fossil fuels and consuming at the pace we're consuming, it's not very long. He's talking about, and a lot of them are talking about, just the year 2070. I mean, I'll be gone, but that's not very long from now. That's only a couple of generations down the road that all the cities on coastal land in the world, so we're talking New York City and Tokyo and San Francisco, will be underwater. How are we in this short amount of time going to move the infrastructure of all the coastal cities of the world inland? It's not going to happen. I get very worried about the future of the human race. And we could worry about nuclear war, surely. We could worry about the irresponsibility of certain people with access to nuclear bombs. I'm personally much more worried about what we're doing to planet Earth and our oceans and our rising of the sea table than anything else in terms of our living safely and happily on the planet.
Well said. We have some swimmers in the audience, and several of them are keen to know about your training sessions. Did you do mostly freestyle? Did you mix it up? What do you recommend to people, young swimmers and older swimmers, the masters?
Well, you know, it's not a matter of recommending, because what I was doing, I've mentioned several times in this talk that, you know, there are swims where it doesn't matter how long it takes you to get across. You just want to make it across. The time is not an issue. In this swim, it's not the time. It's that you will not make it all the way to the Florida coast because of this easterly dragging current that's going 4 to 5 times your speed. You will not make it if you don't put your head down and do freestyle. And you can't take long breaks. This isn't a time to lie back as I do on training swims sometimes because nobody cares. I could take a 2-minute break because I'm training for Cuba and I need to make those breaks short, so Bonnie would always encourage me. But if I feel like lying back on my back and looking out at the 4 billion stars that night and reminiscing about what I read in a Stephen Hawking book the night before, why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't I take in the majesty of the universe? But in the Cuba swim, there's nothing but freestyle. You need to be northing. You need to be pushing north all the time. So a little slow backstroke. You know, I would have to resort to a breaststroke with a dolphin kick when I was injured, and I couldn't keep up the pulmonary demands of freestyle. But you're not going to get there that way. So it's not a matter of what I would recommend to other people. It depends. You know, in training, you know, it's wonderful to mix things up. Like all of the cross training is the big thing now, right? You don't even just swim. You know, mix in a lot of different kinds of sports and exercise. And surely, you know, there's somebody who has butterflied across the English Channel now. I mean, that's fantastic. It's almost unimaginable. But so it's not a matter what I would recommend for you. I just know for me, it was freestyle. It was put your head down and go the strongest, fastest stroke. I don't mean in sprinting, but the most steady, persistent, northing stroke you can do.
So let's return to your beloved Cuba. You've talked at length, you've written at length in your book about your beloved Cuba. You love the country, you love the people. Do you take a wee bit of credit for this recent rapprochement of President Obama with Cuba?
Only a wee bit. I would love to be involved with Cuba in the future. And, you know, as you know, all kinds of people from John Kerry to financiers are involved with the diplomatic, the political, the financial ends of what's going to happen between the two countries. And we are very interested in the financial ends of it all. I would love to be involved, and I think the swim, and President Obama has said to me himself that what we did was a human-to-human connection between our two people. So I'm going to do this walk cross-country next summer. It's called Everwalk. And I sort of picture it, well, first of all, the raison d'etre is just the collective health of America, the new phrase going around from Dr. Levine of Arizona State University is Sitting is the new smoking. We are sitting in front of our screens day and night to a degree that is harming our health. A lot of the egregious numbers of obesity, childhood diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, yes, have to do with food and food choices, nutrition, but a lot of it has to do with just plain not moving. This is what Michelle Obama comes from with Let's Move.
So she's going to join you?
Well, you know, she hasn't said formally she will, but President Obama knows about it. He calls me a badass. I mean, it doesn't get
compliment.
Any better than that. But, good. You know, Bonnie and I, my best friend I keep mentioning from the swim, next summer, and picture this, we're going to walk out the Disneyland gates in Los Angeles with 25,000 kids under the age of 14. Kids who are on their screens, addicted to their screens all day, and they're eating cheeseburgers, whatever, but they're not outside. They're not out playing. They're not using their bodies as kids should, as we should. They are going to be the start of it, and they're going to feel like they were the ones who were empowered, who walked the first 5 miles of Everwalk, which we want to become a national institution year after year. The first ones all the way across the country. Just Bonnie and I will do the entire walk from L.A. to D.C., but we're going to pick up. We're going to pick up the 25,000 kids at the start. We're going to pick up, hopefully, a huge number of Native Americans in Gallup, New Mexico, where obesity is a big issue on the reservation. We're going to pick up small groups in 250 different cities and towns, maybe tens of thousands in and out of Chicago, Indianapolis, Cleveland, Baltimore, those bigger places. We want 1 million people to participate, 1 million people to walk with us by the time we have finished in Washington, D.C., and our statement will be, let's become a nation of walkers. Let's everybody start walking to work, walking after dinner together in our neighborhoods, and let's bring all those numbers that have grown to contribute to our ill health down. And I'm probably preaching to the choir here in this particular community, but across the country, we're in trouble in terms of people not moving whatsoever. And every summer after that, Everwalk will have a smaller edition, like walking from Portland, Oregon up to Seattle, walking Bangor, Maine, down to New York City, walking Key West up to Atlanta, and every year we're going to do a different one, and hopefully this is going to become a big deal. People will say, hey, are you doing Everwalk? I'm going to take my vacation this summer. I'm going to join them over at, you know, such and such Minnesota. This is going to be fantastic. So that's my next big thing. I'm a swimmer. I wish I could make it a swimming event, but to get the mass public out there involved, it's going to be all about walking. Is that what you asked about? What were you asking about?
That's a great answer. That's a great answer. So unfortunately, we've reached the point where
Cuba.
Yes, Cuba.
I want to walk the length of Cuba. And the vision of it, there's going to be a little bit different. The vision of that is people to people, is to take 1,000 Cuban Americans who haven't been back. They were exiled. There's been so much anger, as you know, in Florida. They haven't been back since 1959. And 1,000 Cubans who haven't seen those families for all these years, and put those 2,000 people together and walk the length of Cuba. It would take us 35 days to go from Santiago de Cuba to Havana and make that this, and John Kerry knows about this, but I needed to walk across America first and establish Everwalk, but I would love to walk the length of Cuba and sort of give that to the Cuban people.
I think that would be a beautiful gift. So finally, I would love for you, Diana, to read from your book, Find a Way. There's a beautiful passage on page 246, and it's sheer poetry, and it ends in a beautiful song. And I would love for you to read from this and finish with your beautiful singing voice. Thank you, Diana.
Oh, well, me.
No pressure.
Let's see. So this is the fourth summer of training. And Bonnie wasn't with me. She was supportive, but she wasn't going to go a fifth time. She almost saw me die, her best friend, the night of the box jellyfish stings, and she was helpless. She didn't want to go through that again. And she was frank about the fact that she was tired of failing. And she felt that if anybody could have ever done this swim, it would have been me, and it just couldn't be done. Every single day when I enter the front door of my cottage after training, I don't even put my heavy swim bag down. I stand and take in the photograph on the left entrance wall. The frame is a huge mahogany door mounted sideways with a grainy black and white image of a person with his back to the camera facing the sea. He's staring out at the horizon in contemplation, and a few lines from the Pablo Neruda poem, Ode to Salt, are hand-painted on the wood at the bottom. To paraphrase, the poem evokes a kiss from the sea and the notion that one can taste infinitude in that kiss. This is what's churning in my soul, the grasp of infinitude. This reaching for the stars toward infinitude has brought me to a vibrant life. This intimate time in the magic of immersion has carried me to the infinitude of the sea's salty kiss. Lest I dwell on the drudgery of the cruel training hours, standing transfixed before this photograph reminds me that it has been a divine, sensual pleasure coasting across the surface of our earth, bejeweled by our oceans. To be able to glide with balletic rhythm, to feel the power of my stroke in concert with the majesty of the sea has been exalting. Arriving at this state of superlative swimming conditioning was supposed to be in the name of physical training toward a goal, yet it is enough to revel in the sheer delight of skimming mile after mile. I have become an ocean traveler, smooth and efficient, on my own steam, and this intimate love affair with the ocean has opened my entire being to all things possible, to infinitude. This piece of art gives me solace all summer long. It gives me hope. All we need now is for the lips of good fortune to blow a still calm of infinitude across our seas. And we need Bonnie. When Bonnie was a baby, her father would sing to her the old folk song, and now I've taken to singing it at the end of each training swim. My Bonnie lies over the ocean. My Bonnie lies over the sea. My Bonnie lies over the ocean. Oh, bring back my Bonnie to me. Thank you for picking that out. Thank you.
Thank you, Diana Nyad. Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed this afternoon's program brought to you by the Oshman Family JCC and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Diana Nyad, author of Find a Way, Alison Van Diglin, host of Fresh Dialogues, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and web. And now this meeting is adjourned.